are listening to a dramatization of Philip Wiley's novel, Tomorrow, with Orson Welles as your narrator, Mona Freeman as Lenore, and Marshall Thompson as Lieutenant Chuck Connor.
Chuck Connor avoided Lenore by crossing the river to visit Ruth and Jim Williams in River City with the family. Ruth was Beth's sister, surprised in middle life with a new baby, which, plus the season, occasioned the visit. Ruth, wise with surprised motherhood, had solemn theories about matters now.
Honestly, Henry, I don't mean to hurt you, but...
Don't hurt me.
But I just think this alarmism or whatever is bad for the country's nerves. It's certainly bad for the children.
Oh, I don't see it, Ruth, and I've had a couple more children than you have.
I see it, Mother, but I don't hold with it. In these days of homemade psychiatry and everybody his own expert, you're not supposed to acquaint children with the dangers of our world.
Don't be bitter, Charles.
Bitter isn't the word, Jim.
Rorschach tests show how talk of the bomb upset school children.
What did the pioneers tell their kids, I wonder? That there really weren't any Indians? Go out, Roger and Prudence. Get your bitsy scalps peeled off.
The whole thing is silly. War is unthinkable now.
Well, I can think of it, and if I can, some people with worse intentions can, too.
You're an army man. The army has to be alarmist to get its cut of the budget.
That's why we've been caught badly unprepared in two great wars, because we're alarmist? Why?
Oh, it's such a beautiful day. I don't think it's the day or the season for such an argument.
Well, nobody's arguing. I just don't think that...
I'll get it, dear.
It was for Henry. He took it in the bedroom.
Hello?
Henry, where the devil you been?
I've been here. You found me, didn't you?
I've been trying for a half hour. This is CD headquarters. There's a condition yellow. What? You heard me. I've got to break off. Report at once to sector headquarters with full equipment.
Well, is it real?
I'll say it's real. Get with it, fella.
Chuck?
Yeah, Dan?
Can I see you in here a minute?
Yeah, coming.
Dad, you're white.
That was headquarters, son. There's a condition yellow.
Condition yellow?
Do you believe it?
Boy, we've got to believe it. Where's Ted?
Outside tinkering with Jim's car.
We'll pick him up on the way out. We'll tell the others it's a practice alert. Try and look natural now, will you?
They waded waist-high through protest and ridicule to get outside, collect Ted, and get into the car. Then they stepped on it. Chuck dropped Ted and phoned the man the ham radio and left his dad at headquarters and went on to Hink Field, outside of town, to report for duty.
Well, people, maybe Minerva Sloan's transcript didn't murder civil defense in Green Prairie after all. It's a fine turnout.
Give Coley Borden some credit.
Yeah. And a good thing, too, because this is definitely it. The Northern Defense Perimeter reports a large flight of long-range bombers somewhere over Canada at 600 miles per hour or better. Figure it out for yourselves. And thank God we're only a Class 2 target area. Man your posts. Get cracking.
W00 CDJ calling W00 TKC. Are you there, Ted Connor? Come in, old man.
Connor here. W00 TKC. Come in, W00 CDJ. Over.
Pittsburgh and Detroit have been hit. New York and San Francisco don't answer. Inform your sectors. This is it.
Stand by, W00 CDJ. I have a call. Hello?
What do you hear, son?
I've got headquarters. Pittsburgh and Detroit are gone. New York and San Francisco don't answer.
Good God. Is Mother home yet?
I don't think so.
Report to HQ. My sector is about 45% mustered. Doctors and surgeons are being the worst. We hope they're following the plan and leaving town, but we're not hearing about it. You got it?
Got it. Why don't they let go with the sirens?
That'd be condition red. Enemy planes actually headed for us. This is a yellow.
W00TKC. Reporting in sector, Warden Henry Connor. 45% of all available personnel mustered.
Six jet fighters were taking off from Hink Field when Chuck Connor showed his pass and was passed into operations. It was very still in operations. The field staff looked silently at the big map with the little flags on it. civilian was Harvey Garrett, civil defense director for Green Prairie. General Boyce spoke.
Gentlemen, now appears that a smaller assault wave is approaching from the south. Note that it seems to have broken into three parts. Nothing is yet coming our way.
Thank God for that.
So far, Mr. Garrett.
General Boyce, the scarlet flags on San Francisco, Detroit, New York, and Pittsburgh, what do they signify, sir?
H-bombs. Some of the attacks were made and will be made by guided missiles launched from the air and homing on the cities. Now, their range exceeds our radar range of 200 miles, which would allow us to condition red for only a matter of minutes. Something for the civil authority to think very hard about, Mr. Garrett.
Our downtown area is jammed with shoppers. A condition red would sign the death warrant of thousands. Sound the siren and they panic.
It's up to you, Mr. Garrett.
We'll wait.
The room was still again. All eyes were on the map and on Lipton at the communications board. Silence. Not a sound. The last of the fighters had departed. Some never to return. Over the entire continent, the sky was peopled by young Americans and their dying enemy. After the first half hour, the young Americans, the sophomore college fullbacks, the Marowells, the hot pilots, the forlorn hopes, didn't bother to fire their rockets. When they saw a red star, they dived and they died, knowing that they'd struck at a target which no man could afford to miss. An entire fire company ground and tore and ricocheted south, heading out of town to be intact and available if Holocaust arrived from the sky, following the doctors and nurses out of town to safety and to be in reserve. Netta Bailey found it disturbing. Additionally disturbing, on top of having Lenore back from the beauty shop, where headquarters had finally reached her with a cryptic message about yellow goods, which had sent her flying home.
Lenore, you're doing this to annoy me, I know.
Sure, Mother. But keep the radio on, that's all.
You're not going to cut a party and break a date with Chip Sloan for any fool alert.
Well, I am as soon as I get the suit zipped.
Oh, that idiotic, ugly radiation suit. And that silly box. They're not fit for a young woman.
This silly box is a gamma survey meter. And it's as silly as a sailor learning to swim.
Get out of that suit this minute and fix your hair.
Listen to me, Mother. This is an official alert. With a report with full equipment. And I'm late as it is.
Chip will be furious.
Well, that'll make two of you.
Well, what do I tell him?
To keep the radio at 6:40 or 12:40 for emergency instructions.
Bailey.
Good morning, Minerva.
What's the matter with everybody? All the tellers look bilious. Is this a bank or a clinic?
And there's a yellow alert. The most terrific rumors. Enemy planes everywhere. Big cities not answering calls.
I just had lunch at the Ritz, and there was absolutely no sign of any such nonsense.
Well, nobody's supposed to know yet, but it's official.
Preposterous.
Well, look at TV. They go through the motions, but nobody looks natural. They know, I bet. Just look at the TV.
I will.
She did. Automata simpered at her from the screen. A premonition of horror seized her.
They do look odd. Oh, it's silly. I'm going home. I'll telephone you.
She can drop dead. I'm going home. I'm the head of a family.
Coley Borden, former managing editor of the Transcript, presently unemployed, took the elevator to his old offices in the Sloan Building. He had a small Christmas gift for his former secretary. The smell and the sounds were fondly remembered. But there did seem to be something wrong with everybody. Where Chuck Connor stood by in operations at Hank Field, Lipton at the communications panel handed up a note to General Boyce.
Gentlemen, three planes, four-engine turboprop bombers now diverted from main wing. Green Prairie, River City. Probable destination. Approach in sector 209. And the enemy bomber carrier is probably equipped to launch medium-range missile.
We're in for it, sir.
Mr. Garrett, you're the director of civil defense in Green Prairie.
Condition red.
May God have pity on them.
Take cover. Take cover!
Take cover! Nada, where are you? Turn off the gas!
with you.
Turn off the gas. It's a red alert. Condition red. Turn off the gas. Did you turn off the gas?
The last pamphlet Lenore gave me said not to, I think. Why?
Why? It's condition red. It isn't practice. It's the bomb. The bomb is coming.
Oh, my God. No.
Turn off the gas anyway. I'm going for water or something.
In River City, where there wasn't any civil defense, Jim and Ruth Williams barely heard the sirens from across the river. Where there was civil defense.
What do you think, Jim?
Well, what about?
There wasn't anything in the paper about a practice alert. You see anything? Turn on the radio, huh?
Well, let's see. 6:40 or 12:40, wasn't it?
Maybe I should get the baby. I know she's sleeping, but Chuck seems so sold on the possibility.
Chuck, he's Army, dear. They've got to be sold.
And I repeat, this is Connell Rat. This is not a practice, not a drill. The condition of confidential alert.
There it was. Incredible and shattering. Connell Rat, the emergency broadcasting system, with the authenticity of an organized nightmare, was saying evenly that the atom was on the way. Homing on Green Prairie and River City.
Dear Father in Heaven.
And what would the Founding Fathers say? What, O Lord, against the fury of the sun and the cosmic technology of the ruthless and the despot, availeth us the Kentucky rifle, the musket? What availeth that declaration which we fashioned on July 4th, 1776 in Congress assembled? What availeth it the sword against the lightning?
Baby.
I don't believe it.
With a siren, the editorial offices of the Transcript had emptied in a wild brouhaha of panicked exit. Coley Borden stood alone, looking out of the window of his former office. Bemused, he looked down at the ants in the street in an anthill upheaval. People were already beginning to die down there. Just as they were beginning to die in the crush of the stairwell behind him. The streets were packed solid with cars and trucks, and people were running across the tops of the sardined autos to get out of there. He saw a tiny purple doll of a young woman fall, and 100 people instantly using her body as a step to the tops of the cars. Here and there, a round scarlet blob was a department store Santa Claus, clawing for his life. Siren moaned the stillness. But there was no peace. From the street came a continuous shriek of thousands of men, women, children, slowly dying, slowly being broken to bits. The fused, clotting outcries of many agonies rising as one hideous cry. Coley Borden closed his eyes. It was no good closing his ears. He opened his eyes again and saw it. It came slanting down toward him. The long, slim, steely, monstrous dot cannonading down the sky to target zero.
There it is.
Unimaginable blaze filling the sky. Shadowless, piercing, strident, hellish light. Universes exploding. Fire stars in collision. Blinding, spacious, super solar lightning. Coley Borden vanished. A gas, an incandescent, with a universal incandescence that melted the skyscrapers, dissolved their steel bones, plummeted their stone carcasses into the buckling streets, miraculously emptied now of its frenzied crowds. Beyond, the land was in convulsion, surging with heat and twisting avalanches of blast. At zero was zero.
nothing. A flat, blinding desert of incandescence. Over it, glowing a toxic lavender and orange, the fireball raced upward, up over the goats of the Cheyennes and the Sioux and the 9th United States Cavalry and ancient struggle, the buffalo and the hungerers, and the long, long lines of covered wagons seeking a nation. Connor, at wrecked sector headquarters in the outskirts of town, got up groggily. Bricks still cataracted into the schoolyard. People moved. People didn't. Two men in white tin hats weaved toward him.
I'm all right. See who's alive.
Hint of danger, Kit Sloan had circumspectly tooled his sports car into the country and opened her up. The city was far behind him when the light seared the sky. He didn't know that Minerva, his goddess mother, lay with both legs broken and that she was being wheeled to an aid station in a cement-crusted... Astonishingly, Civil Air Patrol already had planes in the air, assessing the damage, directing the rescue. Astonishingly, things lived. Thought. Acted. Incredible.
Sweet and low. Sweet and low. Wind of the western sea.
Sweet, the blast wave had caught Ruth Williams at a window. She was almost unhurt. The new baby caught a pound of glass on its back and was a tatter in Ruth's arms. Jim was out looking aimlessly for a doctor and soaking up radiation that would make Ruth a quietly crazed widow in 2 weeks. Lieutenant Charles Connor, assigned to auxiliary police duty on a weapons carrier, found his dad in his sector and they took time to share a cigarette.
Last I heard, the District of Columbia was just a white-hot saucer.
What about...
The president is dead.
Yeah.
Most of his cabinet, most of Congress.
We were lucky.
Los Angeles County, a bowl of hot gravel. Nothing.
We'll be looking at old movies for a long time.
They shot a couple of looters.
Poor guy. Probably out of their heads.
Lenore's dad was one of them.
Bruce? Oh.
I didn't know until after. It was almost as though he wanted to be shot.
A hurricane draft whooped and galloped through the shambles, tearing apart tottering houses, knocking over the weak and injured, thundering toward the firestorm, raging in the center of town. A titanic solar fire rose 1,000 feet into the sky at target zero. The terrible solar firestorm that nothing could stop. The city roared like a volcano, and the night shook with the frenzy of that monstrous apocalypse of flames. It was this fire, sucking in cubic miles of air every second to feed it, that drew that wild gale galloping and hooting through the desolate city. For it rendezvous with the universal combustion. The wild wind plunged toward the fire with destruction. The wild mob plunged away from it. For here it was. Here was the gigantic panic, uncontrolled, hideous, that the experts were sure could never happen.
No, no, don't answer it. They're wild. They'll kill you for just a glass of water.
Well, you can't be sure. Might need help.
No, please, don't.
I'll get my shotgun just in case.
Kit Sloan had stopped at a farmhouse. The gas tank was almost empty. farmer and his wife and three fresh-looking daughters were scared, but hospitable. But...
Yeah, I hear you.
What may I be doing for you, Fran?
Hold it! Come on, boys! Help yourself!
Well, now, wait. Look, you men move on. This is a private home. You've done murder. Now, go on. Move on, I said. Go on.
Shall we let him have it, fellas?
No! No!
No! Kit didn't even stop for the dead farmer's gun. He just wanted to get away. He was peeling off again. Never mind the women and the farmhouse. Escape.
Hey, Red! Get that shirt!
Flame had squirted once from a truck parked darkly on the highway. And once was enough. Overhead, a helicopter windmilled toward the shambles. Under the civil defense crash plan, food was being flown in. Parachuted down and more coming. Every trained person who could help was pouring into the sister cities. Food, medical supplies, men, wax and even waves. Communications and signal people, doctors, nurses. The Mars man, bizarre in a yellow radiation-safe suit, was an Earth girl named Lenore Bailey. Weighted down with instruments that clicked or that waved, needled wildly, she moved in ahead of men who were cautious only because they wanted to live long enough to find their friends and neighbors, dead or alive. On a little mountain outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, several men gathered in a large and famous shrine. It belonged to a former president. The house was Monticello, on Thomas Jefferson's beloved Little Mountain. The new president, who had just taken his oath, spoke solemnly to the remnants of his cabinet, to the Congress of the United States.
Gentlemen, three possibilities face us. The first is surrender. Second, we can continue our assault on the enemy. I assure you he is suffering severely. In time, our effort may be as effective as his own. Meanwhile, his assaults will continue. In the end, civilization itself may be ended. There is a third alternative. For years, a United States fleet submarine has been in readiness, converted to the most immense thermonuclear bomb ever assembled. She is at this moment lying submerged in the North Sea awaiting orders. The detonation of this appalling weapon would utterly devastate the enemy. It involves grave risks. But against these is the certainty of world domination by a single despotic power. Now, this is not a decision to be reached out of sheer vengeance or death agony. We must decide quickly how much we esteem the world we live in and how courageously we'll face the controversy that will rage about this decision to the end of history. Now, think, gentlemen.
They could have seen it from the planets. If there were eyes on Mars, they could have seen it without aid. In a split second, the Gulf of Finland evaporated. The dust and the debris of the enemy was flung to the Urals beyond. Some of the American cities came back. Green Prairie came, unlike River City, or abandoned scar tissue on the land. Speechless monuments to improvidence. They say half of the dead might have lived. They say half of the terribly maimed and burned might have been unscathed. They were told. They didn't listen.
Sleep, my pretty one.
Ruth Williams still believes that it is that perfect gem quality Saturday morning before Christmas. That the baby is in her arms. And the Jim has just stepped out for a few cans of cold beer. And will presently be back. Tad is thinking of entering medical school. Wonder should he get married, though. Lenore already is married. Mrs. Charles Connor faces the aftermath of Armageddon like the women who came to the River Abenakis in covered wagons.
Dr. Lister says that a quarter of the babies by raid mothers don't quite make the grade. I'm afraid I caught some of the irradiation, Chuck.
Yeah. Well, 75% is passing.
Sure.
What, O Lord, against the fury of the sun and the cosmic technology of the ruthless and the despot, availeth us the Kentucky rifle, the musket, and the naked faith and valor of our forefathers? What availeth that declaration which we fashioned for freedom in July 1776, and our lives jeopardy? What availeth it these sacrifices? And the sword of yesterday against the lightning of tomorrow.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Administrator of Civil Defense, the Honorable Val Peterson.
More and more Americans are coming to understand why this nation must have a strong civil defense. I think the contribution by this station of its valuable time and facilities to bring you this program is symbolic of that growing understanding. I deeply appreciate this contribution to the nation's welfare and security. In our modern way of life, civil defense has become synonymous with survival. If war should come, and we know the lessons of self-protection which civil defense teaches, the chances that each of us and our families will survive are tremendously increased. But we can benefit in peacetime, too, from our participation in and support of civil defense. The work of civil defense organizations in natural disasters, such as floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, and even industrial explosions or other accidents, has proved that civil defense is an integral and necessary part of our daily lives. Yet civil defense has still another meaning, and one that is tremendously important. One that can spell the difference between war and peace. It is simply this. A civil defense so strong that aggressors will be convinced that an attack on us would not be worth the risk can serve to keep the war from happening. This concept of civil defense as a deterrent to war has, I believe, been best expressed by President Eisenhower. During one discussion of our security problems and the steps being taken to deal with them, the President said, "There are three elements that are basic to achieving a just and lasting peace in this country, and this civil defense program is one of these efforts. First," he said, "we must be strong enough in terms of military defense to deter the enemy. Second, the world must know that we have a strong retaliatory power." But, the president said, "Third, there must be a knowledge on the part of the enemy that this nation cannot be demoralized, that it cannot be panicked, that it cannot be thrown into a state of chaos by the kind of bombing that is possible under modern warfare conditions and the use of nuclear weapons." And he said that third element will be one of the great pillars of strength for building a just and lasting peace in this world. To achieve this kind of preparedness, we need, first of all, trained and self-reliant families. Call your civil defense director today and learn how you can prepare your home. You'll find it good insurance in any kind of disaster, from family emergencies to enemy attack.
The Federal Civil Defense Administration is grateful to Orson Welles, Mona Freeman, and Marshall Thompson for contributing their services to this transcribed program. It also wishes to thank Philip Wiley for permission to dramatize his novel, Tomorrow, which was published in the hardback edition by Reinhardt and Company and in the softback edition by Popular Library. The radio adaptation was by Milton Geiger. Our director was William Carn. Original music was composed and conducted by Albert Harris. Cornwell Jackson produced. Your announcer, James Wallington.